I'm here to dispel the very sweet and happy image of the story of Hanukkah that you grew up with. I'm here to blow that. I'm just kidding. I want you to continue to have positive images of the holidays in which you were raised, but I also want you to have an accurate understanding of what was happening in the Jewish community at that particular time, and what it is we're actually celebrating, because Hanukkah and its celebration, I think, is highly misunderstood. Is that a negative enough way to start our class? Okay, good. I want to intrigue you a little also, and it's the truth. I really believe this. When is this story, and by the way, its proximity to Christmas is also pretty interesting as well, and probably accounts for its popularity as well. We're going to talk about that in a quote from Hermann Wolk a little later. So when did this story actually take place? Is anyone else smoiling in here, or is it just me?
111 BC.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. Okay, when does the story take place?
BC.
Can I give you a little bet? You know what? Better than a date. Better than a date.
Just to give you an overall Jewish helicopter view of Jewish history, real quickly. Who built the first temple?
Solomon.
King Solomon built the first temple. It stood for approximately 410 years. It was destroyed by the
Babylonian
Empire. Excellent. Okay? The Babylonian Empire destroys the first temple in the year 586 BCE. Are you trying to confirm if I'm saying this correctly? Hawaii. Good to see you. Okay.
You're the historian.
I'm not actually an historian, but I read a lot. So, 586 BCE. Thank you. 586 BCE, the first temple is destroyed. What happens to most of the Jewish people when the Babylonians destroy the temple? They get exiled to
Babylon.
Where is Babylon?
Babylonia.
Ancient Babylonia. It's modern-day Iraq, basically. And they're living there under Babylonian rule, essentially, until who comes and topples the Babylonian Empire?
Koresh,
very good. The Persians. Now, give you a little. The Persians, that's when the Purim story takes place. So this Hanukkah story hasn't happened yet. It happens later than the Purim story. Because the Purim story is happening when? During the Persian Empire, who toppled the Babylonians. You just got to remember your empires. It actually starts Egyptian, Assyrian, but we're starting with Babylonian, so it's okay. Babylonian, Persian. Who destroys the Persian Empire?
Greeks.
The Greeks under?
Alexander.
Who was his name? Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great lives about 150 years before the Hanukkah story. Okay? So he's not existing during this time, but Alexander the Great is kind of part of it. We'll come back to that a little later. So Alexander the Great sweeps the ancient Near East and topples the Persian Empire, and the Jewish people eventually living in Israel. Big announcement in Israel today. Maybe we'll touch on that. They basically become a colony, like most of ancient Greece, Babylonia, Persia, Rome. They were just empires. The British Empire, even France, and these were countries that took over many, many different areas. Now, Persians destroy the Greeks, were destroyed by the Greeks under Alexander the Great. When Alexander himself was killed, he was actually a great philosopher, considered himself a student of Aristotle, and his top three generals took over and divided his kingdom into three parts. And the part that is relevant for us and Jews and the Hanukkah story is called the Greek Seleucid Empire. So if you ever see the Seleucid, S-E-L-E-U-C-I-D, the Greek Seleucid Empire, famously run by the bad boy of the Hanukkah story, the tyrant, his name was Haman's the bad dude in Purim. Who's the bad in, what's his name?
Antiochus,
excellent. Antiochus. There's a place called Antioch after him. And the Syrian prince, Antiochus, a Greek ruler over Jerusalem, where the Jews were. Now, is the temple standing? Because we didn't talk about the temple. When did the temple get rebuilt? It was destroyed by the Babylonians But it was only rebuilt 70 years later under the more new, tolerant Persian Empire. So when the Greeks come in, topple the Persian Empire, the Jews are living around their temple. Life is focused on the temple. Most of the Jewish community, if not all the Jews in the world at that time, are primarily in Israel, okay, and worshiping God in the temple. Okay. Now Antiochus, he was really, you know, Antiochus was almost like a pharaoh. So he was called Antiochus the Fourth. Was very ambitious, and he hoped to expand not simply Greek political control and sovereignty over the many different cultures and ethnicities and minority groups over which they reigned, but also he wanted to centralize everyone ideologically under some philosophy that was sweeping the ancient Near East. What was that philosophy called? It's called Hellenism. And I don't want to spend a lot of time on Hellenism, but Hellenism was very much connected to the body, the physical. And it rejected any kind of belief in the supernatural or spiritual. A good Greek Hellenist, this is connected with Zeus, the Greek god Zeus, and Hercules. They were statues all over the place. This is when the Olympics actually began to develop, and athletics, and the beautiful art form of the body, which was actually worshipped. And one of the things that Jews who were being influenced by Hellenism started to do, actually, was to hide their circumcisions. Even though the Greeks, according to some, we know that they forbade circumcision. They forbade many mitzvot, but circumcision for them, the Hellenists, was considered like sort of sacrilegious, because you were defaming the body. The body is perfect. The body is to be worshipped. The here and now, the physical senses. So you can understand the clash of these two cultures. Classical Judaism has brought the concept of one and only supernatural, transcendental God to the world, and the Hellenists are all about the here and now and the physical. And don't put it together with Alexander the Great or Aristotle and Plato and some of the great Greek philosophers. It's a different time, and it's a little of a different philosophy. The only thing that's similar is that Alexander the Great was a philosopher, and he was interested not simply in governing large swaths of the world politically, but he actually wanted to Hellenize. I mean, or his progenitors, Antiochus, they wanted to Hellenize the people. And this is really important, because their goal was not to squash and annihilate and destroy. Their goal was to Hellenize. And that's why the story is very different than the Purim story. Because what was Haman out to do, really? Destroy the Jews, physically. Annihilate. It was genocide. It was like Hitler. Did Hitler care if you were an Orthodox Jew, a conservative Jew, a Reformed Jew, a Hasidic Jew? He was out to kill. The Greeks did. They cared if you were a practicing Jew or not, and they wanted Judaism as a philosophy, as an ideology, as a lifestyle, blotted out. Now, there are lots of Jews who became great Hellenists, who wanted to be, and this is a reoccurring theme in our history, wanted to be more Greek than Greeks. And the big bad story that I want to share with you tonight is that it's not a simple thing that the Jews were just praying every day, and they were learning Torah, and they were trying to keep their mitzvot, and the big bad Greeks came along and said, stop with that Torah, stop with that mitzvot, be Greek and be Hellenistic. It didn't start that way, actually. It started by Jews themselves beginning to be influenced by this new ideology called Hellenism. And I want to share with you a couple of little insights and vignettes into what was happening. Who was the most important leader in the Jewish community at that time when the temple stood? Well, in general, when there's a temple, the high priest, the Kohen Gadol. And the Kohen Gadol was a man by... the kahuna was through a great sage named Shimon HaTzadik, and through him came Chonyo, and Chonyo was the rightful high priest. He was the Kohen Gadol, but Chonyo had a brother whose name was Jason, and it sounds almost like made up. Jason was a Hellenized name, and Jason, who had Hellenized himself, offered Antiochus a bribe to depose his own brother in return for him to be appointed as the new Kohen Gadol, as the high priest. And Antiochus did this. He appointed Jason as the new Kohen Gadol. And Jason promised the king more money, another 150 talents of silver, if he would authorize the building of a gymnasium for the youth of Jerusalem. What's wrong with building a gymnasium in Jerusalem? Got to go to the gym and work out. So when you get to shul, you can pray with better focus, no problem. These were now ordinary gymnasiums. These were the games that were played in the nude. They would bring sacrifices to Hercules and Zeus and to these Greek gods before the game started. That's why you see to this day the Olympics. You have all that kind of imagery still going on.
Okay, I thought you said that in the Hellenism they didn't believe in the spiritual supernatural.
They didn't. This is not. The Greek gods were these physical statuesque, and the body was, and the physical, it was, they didn't have, it was not a spiritual, transcendental, non-physical. It was very physical, just because they had gods. I mean, you study Greek mythology, you know, it's not spiritual. You know what I mean? It's
the gods are warring each other.
Right, right. They're fighting each other. They're killing each other. It's a whole, right. So getting back to the gymnasium, why does he build a gymnasium? And he wants to build a gymnasium close to the temple. Why? Why do you do that? He wants to lure the young Kohanim and the young Jewish men from the temple service into the gymnasium and cultivating these practices of the Greek pagan customs to such an extent that the Kohanim began to neglect the temple service in favor of Jason's new center, his new gymnasium. And the gymnasium was primarily used for athletics, but was also a vehicle for paganism and promiscuity. Exercises were performed in the nude. Josephus, the great historian, writes that Jewish boys, I mentioned before, took pains to disguise their brisses. Before the games were held, sacrifices were offered to Hercules. And in order to qualify as an honorary citizen of Antioch, which was the Syrian Seleucid capital, okay, the Jews had to demonstrate total acceptance of the Greek way of life. And when the years came by, about 3 years passed, and the time came for Jason to pay off the king for the building of this gymnasium, in 171 BCE, to give you a little date, Jason was removed from office by Antiochus and replaced him with Millenius. You gotta love these names. These are all Jews, Millenius. Millenius, who was once an emissary of Jason, used his position to undermine Jason and was appointed the new Kohen Gadol. Now, you don't get appointed the Kohen Gadol. It's not an office you run for. Okay, but they were basically trying to corrupt the priesthood and the temple and Hellenize it. And it's all happening by Jews, you understand. And it wasn't started by Antiochus. The Greek Hellenism was sweeping the ancient Near East, but Jews were picking up on it, and they were fighting each other as to who could be considered more Greek than the next. In order to pay off this huge amount of money, this debt to Antiochus that Jason left, Millenius and his brother Lysimachus, I don't make these names up, who acted as his deputy, took the gold vessels of the temple, the Jewish temple, and sold them to raise money and to pay off Antiochus. When Chonyo, the real Kohen Gadol, protested, they had him killed. And it was essentially almost a civil war starting to develop in the Jewish community itself. And there are a lot of details about what was happening in the Jewish community, but it was developing and they were starting to be pagan altars that were set up throughout ancient Judea. They started imposing edicts upon the Jewish people, banning mitzvot like circumcision, like Shabbat, like just basic Jewish practices under the penalty of death, requiring Jewish people to actually bring these offerings and these sacrifices to their Greek gods. And this is going on and going on and going on for quite a while until anybody know what happened. What's that? Right, so the revolt began. Virtually every part of Judea was bombarded by Hellenism and all of these Greek pagan altars and deities in every village in ancient Judea. Matityahu, who was the son of Yochanan, the high priest, left Jerusalem and settled in a Judean village near Jerusalem called Modia. And he refused publicly to sacrifice to the idol that was set up in that town, and actually publicly killed somebody who was doing just that, and declared, whoever is zealous for the Torah and is steadfast in the covenant, let him follow me. And Matatiyahu's five sons, who we know as the Maccabees, rescued their father and fled to the mountains in the Judean desert. And many other loyal Jews began to follow, and the beginnings of a rebellion, of a revolt against the Greek Seleucid legions began. The king's forces had to deal with this challenge and to his authority, and they began to look for these Jews hiding out in the Judean hills. Only about 6,000 Jews had actually gathered under the banner of Matatiyahu. They began to strike back at the Syrians in night raids. They would destroy the idolatrous altars that were set up by the pagans. And the revolt had begun. And by the time Matatiyahu, the father, died in the year 165 BCE, the war against the Syrian Greeks was now in full force. Anybody know the names of Matatiyahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol? He had five sons. One was Shimon. The most famous one was
Judah.
We named our third son because he was born on the fourth night of Hanukkah. We named him Judah after Yudah HaMaccabee. Number three was Elazar. Number four was Yochanan. Number five was Yonatan. And the father, literally on his deathbed, told the sons to follow the advice of Shimon, because he was supposed to be the wisest, but to look to Judah the Maccabee for leadership in battle. Apollonius gathered soldiers. He was a Greek officer to attack Judah. Now they're sending more and more forces from the capital in Athens to Jerusalem to put down the revolt. And Judah was forewarned, struck first in advance, killing Apollonius and much of his armies, taking their arms. You don't have to get all these details. I just want to paint a little picture of what was happening. Siron, the commander of the Syrian army, heard about this, and he figured he could make a great name for himself by putting down this rebellion, these Jews, and he gathered a well-equipped army, marched into Judea. But it was Judah's raw valor that rallied the Jewish forces, strengthening them for a very long battle ahead. Philip and Apollonius, these two main generals, tried to destroy the Hashmonaim. That's another word for the family of the Maccabees, the Hasmonites, Hashmonaim. But instead suffered serious setbacks at Nablus and Beit Horon. Again, you don't have to get these details. Antiochus sent a third general, Siron, with a far larger army to Beit Horon. Judah and his forces defeated that army as well. They killed 800 of Siron's forces. This, of course, enraged Antiochus, who swore to crush the Jewish rebellion. But he had a lot of other problems going on. Antiochus, his treasury was now depleted. He spent money like crazy, lavish personal spending, campaigns of conquest. He had to pay a tribute to Rome. And then he invaded Persia to collect what he thought was the money owed to him in tribute. He was bogged down in Persia, so he appointed his blood relative Lycia to take over the fight against the Jews in his absence. And the rest of the war was now in Lycia's hands. Lycia appoints three of ancient Greek's top generals, Ptolemy, silent P, Nicanor, and Gorgias. You're going to hear why I'm giving you all these details. It's okay if you don't get it. And I'm not a historian. I'm reading some of these in my notes I took. Three of Syria's best generals to lead the Judean campaign. I want you to understand, they put them in charge of an army of 40,000 foot soldiers and 7,000 cavalry, means on horses. They invade, they march into Judea. They were so confident that the Syrian Seleucid Greeks would win that Nicanor, one of those three generals, summoned Gentile slave dealers along the coast, promising them Jewish slaves at unprecedented low prices. Like, we're going to come in, wipe them out, we're going to have all these slaves that you're going to be able to have. And the Syrian army encamped around the town of Emmaus, M-M-A-A-U-S, which is very interesting, because Emmaus is near Latrun. Does anybody know where Latrun is? Latrun was, if you go to today, Latrun is a military memorial, a place where a lot of the IDF does their exercises. There's also a memorial there to all of the Israelis that have fallen in different wars. There's tanks there. Little kids go and play. It's near mini Israel, which is also a fun part. Where in this battle, this is over 2,000 years ago, takes place. Ben Gurion tried to take Latrun in 1948. Was unsuccessful. We were unsuccessful. We took it in 1967 though, and it's back in Jewish hands. The Syrian army encamped near this area, Latrun, and Yehuda gathered his forces in Mitzpah, which, by the way, is the biblical site and home of the grave of Samuel, the prophet, just 12 miles from Emmaus, which is near Latrun. And with some very sophisticated military deception and a lot of courage, Yehuda outmaneuvered the far larger and better equipped Syrian armies. He splits up his forces into different battalions. Each of his brothers are leading a different battalion. He forces the Syrian forces to divide and destroys its smaller components, killing thousands and forcing the survivors to flee north to Syria. This is essentially the last of any Syrian force to occupy Judea, and the revolt was successful in sweeping Greek forces from Israel. They were the first and only colony of the Greek Empire ever to kick the Greeks out. And what was the first thing that the Maccabees, this family of Kohanim, the Hashmonaim, did when they were successful? And just imagine the scene. And this is where the Talmud picks up. I'll get to this in a minute. What did they do? What was the first thing they did? They had made a big party. They went to the temple. Because what was the temple at this point? Temple was completely turned into a pagan place of worship. Everything was desecrated, and they wanted to make sure that at least the menorah should be lit, because the menorah was supposed to be lit by the Kohen every day. It's a verse in the Torah, and it was lit every day since the days of Aaron, Moses' brother. And they went in to light the menorah, and they could only find one cruse of pure olive oil, and somehow it lasted 8 days, which was long enough time to give them to obtain fresh supplies and continue the menorah lighting each and every day. And that's the holiday in a nutshell. So I have a question for you.
Why the menorah again? Why was that the one thing?
Well, they wanted to light the menorah because the menorah was supposed to be lit every day. Now, you bring sacrifices every day also, but the whole thing was a mess. And there was actually other oil they could find, but they wanted Shemen Zayit. They wanted special high-level spiritual oil. Pure olive oil, that's the best oil to use to light the menorah. You don't have to use that for your menorah. You can use wax candles, but some people like to use olive oil. But I have a very simple question for you. Because by the look on some of your faces, while I was going through all these details, and you can see I'm not an expert at it, I'm looking at my notes here, and there was so much more. I just want to show you. I did a lot of research for this class. These are all my notes on some of the, and my old ones before I was used to type. I put them all together, just a lot of information about these battles. Now, I went to Jewish day school for 12 years, since I'm like 5, and then I went to a year in Israel, and then I went to Yeshiva University for the next 8 years, and then since then I've been studying a lot of Torah. And I'll tell you something, none of this information is found anywhere. There's only one source in the Talmud where we find a lot of this kind of information. And what does the Talmud say? Take a look at your source sheet. Follow with me, please. You with me, guys? Page 1 here, on top. We have another. Here, I have another one for you.
My Chanukah. I'm going to read it. It says Talmud, Shabbat 21. This is the only reference in the entire Talmudic literature about Chanukah. Okay?
What does it say? My Chanukah. What's Chanukah? The Tanur Rabbanan, because our rabbis taught, B'kafhei, the Kislev, on the 25th day of the Hebrew month of Kislev. We're in Kislev now. Yemei de Chanukah Timne Inun. I'll read it in the English. What is the reason for Chanukah? Our rabbis taught on the 25th of Kislev, commence the days of Chanukah, which are 8, on which a lamentation for the dead and fasting are forbidden. God forbid somebody dies during the 8 days of Chanukah. There's a funeral, you have to bury the dead, of course, but you don't have what's called a eulogy at the funeral, because it's such a joyous time, we don't allow for eulogies. People try to get around that sometimes. I've gone, unfortunately, to a funeral on Chanukah, and people feel like jip, they want to say something nice, so you do a tribute, not a eulogy. You figure out a way as best as you can, but you're supposed to tone it down a little because of the joy. And you can't fast. You're not allowed to fast during the 8 days of Chanukah. Why would you fast? Some people fast if they have a bad dream. Some people are doing their own personal tshuva. They may take on a fast. You're not allowed to do that during Chanukah. Chanukah, you got to eat latkes and play dreidel and have a lot of fun. Right? None of that. That's all it says. Why? What happens on Chanukah? I'm going to come back to those details in a minute. Because when the Greeks entered the temple, they defiled all the oils. And when the Hashmonaim dynasty prevailed against them and defeated them, they made search and found only one cruse of oil, which lay with the seal of the high priest, but which contained sufficient for one day's lighting only. Yet a miracle was wrought, and they lit the lamp for 8 days. The following year, these days were appointed a festival with the recital of Hallel. We say Hallel during the 8 days, and Thanksgiving. Now think about that for a minute. What did the Talmud say? What's the miracle according to the Talmud? What's the miracle that we just read in here? The oil. The little fishtunk in a flask of oil that was only for one lasted for eight. Really? What about all this that I just spent 20 minutes going over with you? What about all those crazy wars that a bunch of Kohanim, the elderly guy, the Meshugana, you know, Jew, who kills the guy and his five sons have to take him to Judah, and they kick the Greeks out of Israel? Okay. Ritual is important. We'll come back to it. But where's the miracle of the battle? And let me ask you a question. Why is it that if I want to get details about the battle, because it is a miracle, that battle should not have been won. You study about it. You study Josephus. Here's where the source is. Josephus, Maccabee 1, Maccabee 2. It's called apocryphal literature. It didn't get into the Bible. And it's a lot of details. It's used as a historical source to learn about these wars and what happened during that time. But if you study, anybody here study Greek history, I don't know how much the Greeks kept this. It's a little embarrassing, this part of their history, clearly. But why are the rabbis saying that the miracle was the Pach HaShemen, the cruse of oil? What about the miracle of the fight, the battle, the fact that a small group of rebels kicked out the prominent, you know, Greek legions? What do you think?
Well, that has to do with the actions of men, in the sense that it's their drive, it's their decision to sort of follow Hashem's ways, to do all of these things, and then they have the inspiration and all of that, and, you know, the wits and the strength and whatever it is to have this miracle happen, but ultimately it's something that happens between, sort of, in this world. Whereas the oil is something about them trying to be with God, and that's something about their sort of their spiritual aspect, as opposed to just defending their right to, I don't know if I'm explaining myself well.
But
it's sort of the realm of men versus the realm of God in some
right
way.
Okay, but isn't, which one would you consider more miraculous? Now, I thought what you were saying, and a lot of people suggest this, because a lot of answers to this question. I want to share one with you, and I'll get to it. But one other answer I thought you were touching on, is that, you know, when there's a battle, people could always attribute it to something. Even people who fought in 48 and 60, some people say it was a great miracle, God was with us, and other people are very skeptical. The IDF had great intelligence, we were at the right place at the right time, the Egyptians were eating breakfast at 7:14 in the morning, on that morning when we took off, and they didn't pick up our radars. Other people would be like, come on, really? It was God. But you could have a debate, right? And it's not clear. But when one little cruise of oil that everybody knows scientifically, factually, realistically, can only last for 1 day, lasts for eight, that's a miracle. So that's what some people say. One is physical, one is spiritual. Maybe that's, I don't know, you were touching on that a little. Any other suggestions? Any other ideas? Why would the rabbis not, I'll make the question a little stronger. Can anyone here, besides what happened in our own generation, can anyone here think of any other episodes in Jewish history where, excuse me, we kicked so much butt in such an incredible way?
Well, even the destruction of Jerusalem, even though we lost that one, we still held them off for four years or something ridiculous.
The Bar Kokhba revolt?
No. In the destruction of Jerusalem, the Romans were trying to take Jerusalem for 4 years.
Right, there was a siege, but it was a terrible, bloody massacre at the end of the day. Okay, maybe we held out, you know? You could, but wouldn't we want, like, if I was a teacher in a school, let's say I taught high school kids or even elementary school kids, I'd want to talk about these battles all the time. It makes us look, you know, we got we just keep getting kicked around a lot in Jewish history. Here's an example of where, you know, we held our heads up and we were successful against some pretty powerful people. Why wouldn't we publicize this more? Why wouldn't that be in the Talmud?
Couldn't you play the card of, like, they're rabbis, they're all about spirituality, they don't want to glorify wars and killing, they want to glorify, like, a temple service, you know, like something really...
Okay, so I want to elaborate on that, because I think that is part of the answer. Except without the other rabbis kind of thing. But that's fine. That's fine, because rabbis are not into glorifying battles. Okay? We were the ones who, and we've got that on the United Nations now, we were the ones that always were against war, and war is always a last resort. It is there, it's in the Torah, there were many wars fought by Jews in the Bible, but not if we could avoid it. Okay? So maybe that's a reason we don't want to glorify war. Yeah, let's see.
Maybe like the idea of expectation, so it would be expected for us to defend ourselves, but it wouldn't be expected for something to last.
Right. In other words, and again, one seems so much more supernatural and out of the ordinary than the other. Someone's attacking you, but I'm going to actually combine the two, what you just said. I think that the rabbis played down the military victory and battles and only talked about the little flask of oil. And just, you know, you sort of came in at the tail end of the military victory, if you study the Talmud. It says, and when they prevailed against the Greeks in the battlefield. What happened to the whole battlefield? I believe that if the rabbis had spoken a lot about and spilled a lot of ink in the Talmud over the battles, I think we would misunderstand what this holiday is all about. Because we would interpret Hanukkah like we interpret every other Jewish holiday. They tried to kill us. We survived. Let's eat. And forget about the let's eat part, but that's what we think every Jewish holiday is. They tried to kill us and we survived. Is that Hanukkah?
No.
It is not Hanukkah.
It's Thanksgiving.
It's not Hanukkah. Why is it not Hanukkah? Because what? They didn't try to kill us. They tried to Hellenize us. If we would have been good Greek Hellenists, if we would have simply left the temple and go play in the gymnasium and stop bringing sacrifices to God and start bringing them to Zeus or Hercules, we would have been just fine. There wouldn't have been a battle. The battle actually was incidental. The battle was self-imposed. We didn't want a battle, but if you want to preserve Judaism, you had to battle, because the Greeks basically said, you either follow our ways or... you know, it's our way or the highway. So there was a battle, but the battle was incidental. The battle only happened because we chose to preserve our Judaism in the face of forced assimilation. And I believe that if the rabbis played up all these battles and we talked about it, we'd be so proud of them, we would forget what this holiday is really celebrating. This holiday is not celebrating the physical survival of the Jewish people. This holiday is celebrating the spiritual survival of the Jewish people, the ability for a minority group called the Jewish people to live in a majority culture that is living, thinking differently, and the ability that we have to maintain ourselves as to who we are, our own personal spiritual identity. And I will tell you that this is the same challenge we have today. And that's why I'm so glad that the rabbis left out all this battle information. They left out the battle information so we would focus on what's really being celebrated. And that's the Pach HaShemen. That's the cruse of oil. Because the light represents the Torah. And the Torah ultimately was what was being threatened. And yes, there was a battle, but that's only because we wouldn't give up the Torah. If we would give up the Torah, there wouldn't have been a battle. So don't celebrate the battle. Celebrate what really represents the significance of this holiday. And I think it's so telling in our own day and age, in modernity, that Hanukkah has become as popular in America as it has because of its proximity to another great festival, which only underscores the issue and the struggle that we continue to have with the theme of Hanukkah. It's just, think about it. Purim and Hanukkah are like identically rabbinically instituted holidays. They should be just as popular as the other. Purim, there's no reason from a Torah rabbinic perspective why Hanukkah would be more celebrated than Purim. There's only one reason why Hanukkah is more popular than Purim, and that's because we live in a Christian society that celebrates Christmas. And by the way, nothing wrong with that. And God bless people who celebrate Christmas. But it has somehow inspired us to be more Hanukkah-driven. And yet, because there's nothing near Purim, we're not as aware of Purim. Because I can't really come up with any better reason why there'd be more Jews celebrating one holiday over the other. They're identical. Follow with me from a... Right. Well, we're going to talk about that in a minute. Yeah.
Where did the idea that it gets from?
Where do you think it came from? Yeah. It came from Christmas. It came from Christmas, but they tried to do it with gelt. You know, to make it a little different. No, with money. You know, like giving the kids like some money. But it's completely. There's no. It doesn't say anywhere in the you know about giving kids presents or anything. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's borrowing. Yeah. Yeah.
And he says, like, there is this, like, language of even back, like, well before...
So you're quoting from the... it's in the last chapter. Rambam has three chapters in Hilchos Chanukah. In Perek Gimel, he calls it a mitzvah chaviva, a very special mitzvah, to light the Chanukah candles. Even if you're poor, you have to sell your shirt off your back to be able to afford candles. Although, I'm speaking about this on Saturday night, Shabbos candles are still more important than Chanukah candles.
So, my question is...
Yeah.
Like there, well, at least the way it was presented to me like a long time ago was that there was this idea even way before Norman Rockwell and Coca-Cola of Hanukkah being something that broadly beloved.
Yeah, but not anymore than Purim. I could argue Purim should be more popular. Purim has a book in the Bible called Megillat Esther. Hanukkah doesn't. And Purim, I mean, there's so many other reasons why Purim... I'm just explaining why our generation in America. Follow with me just on the second page, if you can. Yo, please.
Yeah, so let's back in history. So you said that there's only 6,000 people who follow Matityahu.
Well, I don't know if that was the exact number at the end.
A small number of people.
Yeah.
And that most Jews at the time were willingly assimilating. And
I don't know, I don't know about the numbers. Is it most Jews or a lot? It was a very significant...
My question is really, so forgetting about the numbers, but regardless, there's a significant amount of population that is assimilated, which is what we see today. And then there's sort of these people who are willing to revolt for it. So they win the revolt. Okay, and they come back, and all these Jews who have willingly assimilated, what happened there? Right? Like,
well,
is there still a lot of infighting that happens after this?
Yes.
Like, how does this...
Yes, because first of all, even the Hashmonite family, mm-hmm. some say that the rabbis didn't talk too much about the battles because they were upset with the family of Hashmonai and what happened afterwards too. It's not a clean ending. The only thing that was clean is that we kicked the Greeks out. And the Greeks stopped shoving Hellenism down our throats. And the Jewish people were successful against them, so it was clear to the Jews, even the Hellenized ones, that the Jews had prevailed against Hellenism. And the temple was reinstated as a holy place for another 200 years until the Romans came and destroyed it. And the Rambam actually says that V'chazer Malchut, that the Hashmonaim were able to reinstate sovereignty. Anybody know, since the Greeks were kicked out by the Maccabees and we had political sovereignty, okay, and then the Romans came 200 years later, anybody know the next time the Jews got political sovereignty over the land of Israel with Jerusalem as its capital? 1948. Jerusalem as its capital. Right, maybe 67, right. So 1948, it's just very important to know this. People want to know, when was the last time there was political sovereignty? There are always Jews in Israel, and we've been there for a long time, and Yerushalayim was always the capital. Maybe I'll comment on it afterwards. I want to read Hermann Wolk with you before we get off the subject, because I think it's really interesting. Anybody here know who Hermann Wolk is? Anybody read any of his books? You've heard of Hermann Wolk? So he wrote... an amazing book called This Is My God, which I'm going to quote from in a minute. He prayed in the synagogue downstairs. He's 101 years old. He lives in Washington. He should live and be well. He was an incredible... He's a playwright, and he wrote all these books. Cain Mutiny, Marjorie Morningstar. He's written like a dozen books. The Winds of War. Has anyone seen the movie? There are movies about his books. whatever. When I was growing up, he was, I guess, more popular. But and he became closer to his Judaism when he was in his 20s. He was very influenced by Rabbi Young. There used to be a picture right here. When I first came to MGE, of Rabbi Young. He was a rabbi at the Jewish Center, the synagogue downstairs, for over 30 years. And he once came and listened to a sermon. And then they used to take walks around the reservoir right here, Central Park. And Rabbi Young convinced him, because he saw what a brilliant writer he was. He wasn't observant, but he was starting to sort of, his eyes were opening up. My father had Rabbi Young as his professor at Yeshiva University, and he was a very charismatic, brilliant scholar. And Hermann Woke wrote this book at the behest of Rabbi Young. It's called This Is My God. We should really give it out to all the fellows. And sometimes I get voted down on what I want, but you should go online, see if it's still in print, and get the book. It's so good to have. It's got every aspect of Judaism. It's written like a novel, and it's talking about his personal return to Judaism. And he writes so beautifully. Listen to what he says about Chanukah in the book. You guys with me? Okay, follow me on it's the second page of your handout. Oh, by the way, you've heard of Cain Mutiny, I'm sure. Okay, so he wrote that. All right, in 1,000 years, you guys with me? Right here, it says Hermann Woke. In 1,000 years of national existence, on the soil of Palestine, the Jews over and over drove out oppressors and regained independence. But the Maccabean War, a battle for religious liberty, alone found a place in the rites of our faith. It stood out. It was the Jews' first full-scale encounter with the question that was to haunt them in the next 2,000 years, which is, can a small people dwelling in a triumphant major culture take part in the general life and yet hold on to its identity? What do you think the answer to that question is? We're still grappling with that issue, aren't we? Or must it be absorbed into the ranks and the ways of the majority? In the two great worlds of current affairs, the communist empire, he wrote this in the 50s, which so much resembles an ancient military dictatorship, and the tolerant, skeptical, free West, they face the question again. We're going to skip the communists. We don't have time. You can read this on your own. Look at the last paragraph. The challenge of the West is different, though just as serious. The proposition is the old one, that the Jews are confronted with a better way of life and should give up their religion for it. Forces that are not coercive and therefore do not call forth the human impulse to fight them urge Jews along this path. You see the language he uses? Forces that do not call forth the human impulse to fight them. What does that mean? Forces that call upon that do not call upon.
You don't feel attacked.
You don't feel attacked. Does anyone here feel attacked in America about your Judaism? Nobody. No one's putting a gun to your head. You can do whatever you want. Right? Right? The position of the government, and indeed the deep conviction of most American leaders, is that the Jewish community has the right to hold fast to the faith of its fathers and ought to do so. What contradicts them is the tidal wave, turn the page, the tidal force that Tocqueville long ago marked as the great weakness of a democracy in his unforgettable phrase that he coined, the tyranny of the majority. What's the tyranny of the majority mean? It's like peer pressure. What's the tyranny? Tyranny sounds like you're being oppressed. But you're only just being oppressed because everybody else is doing it. No one's telling you you have to. It's just what everyone else is doing. It's the tyranny of the majority. The pressure to emulate neighbors. The urge to conform to popular views and manners. The deep fear of being different. These in the United States are the forces of Antiochus, where the power of the sword long ago failed. The power of suggestion has recently been doing rather better. It would be pleasant to believe that the stabbing relevance of Hanukkah to Jewish life in America has occasioned the swell of the interest in the holiday. But a different and perfectly obvious cause is at work. By a total accident of timing, this minor Hebrew celebration falls close in the calendar year to a great holy day of the Christian faith. This coincidence has all but created a new Hanukkah. It was entirely natural for a new Jewish generation growing up in the United States to feel each December like children in the dark outside a house where there was a gay party. This is before gay was used like that. Gay mean like happy party. Pressing their noses wistfully against the windows. Now can you imagine the scene for a minute? Because he's writing this in the 1950s. Now how did kids grow up in America in the 1950s? What did you feel like in December? Right? That Judaism had its own rich and varied occasions of gaiety was beside the point. most second-generation Jews were but poorly trained in their own faith. And anyway, the Christians had a brilliant midwinter feast, and the Jews did not. Some families, you see the problem? Right? There's nothing really exciting about being Jewish, and everybody's having such a ball with Christmas, and the lights, and the cheer, and the songs. And you're like this schleppy Jewish kid, and you're looking at your neighbors, and they're having a good old time, and what do you have? Some families solve the problem in the simplest way by introducing Christmas trees, Christmas presents, and Christmas carols. I meet so many people, Jewish homes, that have Christmas trees in their homes. Even though there's no interfaith family, they just felt bad for the kids. Just give them a Christmas tree and they won't feel so odd. Right? They argued it was harmful for their children to feel underprivileged.
That's what my mom's parents said, and they put a Christmas tree in her house. And she actually felt more odd because of that.
Okay, right. They argue that it was harmful for their children to feel underprivileged and that the Christmas tree was a mere pleasant ornament of the season without religious content. Meantime, in schools, there were large numbers of Jewish children. A dual celebration of Christmas and Hanukkah sprang up, an official symbol of mutual courtesy and tolerance. This in turn generated a new Jewish interest in Hanukkah. Even those Jews who were celebrating Christmas in their homes, tree holly, born as the King of Israel and all, began to find it seemly to add an electric menorah for their windows, and perhaps even to light the candles. This apparently solved the problem by giving the children the best of both worlds. The aggrandizement of Hanukkah itself is a fortunate accident. The level of knowledge of old Judaism must rise when any part of it happens, for whatever reason, to gain attention. He says it's not so bad. Hanukkah is more popular now because parents just wanted to give their kids something so that they would be happy, not feel left out like their Christian friends. So it sort of occasioned the holiday of Hanukkah. And he says it's not so bad, right? The level of knowledge of old Judaism must rise when any part of it happens, for whatever reason. The son of my skeptical friend is not likely to stop after learning about Hanukkah. What happens when you learn a little something about Judaism that you like? You want more. It says it in the ethics of our fathers, mitzvah goreret mitzvah. You do one mitzvah. That's why we never shove mitzvot down people's throats, because you give a little, you're going to want a little more. A lack of clear and satisfying religious identity hurts American Jews most in December. This is why the apparently trifling issue of the Christmas tree generates such an obduracy and such resentment. It rasps an exposed nerve. It's a good thing that Hanukkah then is at hand. If the old custom of Hanukkah money has become the new custom of Hanukkah gifts, that is a minor shift in manners. The tale of the Feast of Lights, with its all-too-sharp comment on our life nowadays, is very colorful. It is of the greatest use in giving the young a quick grasp of the Jewish historic situation. The gifts win their attention. The little candles stimulate their questions. The observance seems tooled to the needs of self-discovery. Our whole history is a fantastic legend of a single day's supply of oil lasting 8 days. The whole book is like this, by the way, the way he writes. The whole history of the Jewish people is a fantastic legend of a single day's supply of oil lasting for 8. Of a flaming bush that is not consumed. Of a national life that in the logic of events should have flickered and gone out long ago, but is still burning on. That is the tale we tell our children in the long nights of December when we kindle the little lights while the great Christian feast blazes around us with its jewel trees and familiar music. The two festivals have one real point of contact. Had Antiochus succeeded in obliterating Jewry a century and a half before the birth of Jesus, there would have been no Christmas. The feast of nativity rests on the victory of Hanukkah. I just love this article because it really demonstrates the continued struggle that we have with this question that still hangs over us, which is, can we as a minority people hold on to our Jewish identity, be proud of who we are, and not always looking out over our shoulder wondering what's out there that's better? Is it Hellenism? Is it something else? And we're reminded of that each and every year. Every single year, when Hanukkah comes and Christmas comes, and by the way, don't misunderstand me, when they asked me in my building, would I be offended if we had a Christmas tree? I said, why would I be offended if we had a Christmas tree? Let there be a Christmas tree and put in a menorah. We have Jews in the building, we have Christians in the building, we should have both. Right? And and of course they put in a wreath, so nobody would be offended. Nobody's happy either about it. So we were talking about this on Shabbat. And so we live in a country that is not demanding we relinquish our Judaism in order to fit in. That's the beauty of the American experience, that we celebrate diversity and pluralism, and it's okay for you to be different and to be who you are. And yet for some reason we still think that we'll be either more accepted or happier if we just shed our Judaism. I wouldn't say it's as dramatic as these kids, the young Kohanim, covering up their circumcisions in these old gymnasiums. But if you think about what's happened in America, you know, to our people in such a short period of time, it's quite striking. And I think, therefore, when we celebrate Hanukkah, we have to remember, what are we celebrating? We're not celebrating the physical survival of our people. We got other holidays for that. That's Purim. We're celebrating the spiritual survival of our people. That Judaism still has something to say to me. And that Judaism is really something that gives me inspiration, and it's the kind of life I want to live. I don't have to put down other people's way of life and their ideologies and their philosophies to believe in mine. But I also don't have to mimic or mock mine, like unfortunately we tend to do, the self-deprecating Jew who knows so little about their own Judaism and is so attracted to everything else other than what's right before us. And it's something to think about on Hanukkah as we light the candles. And again, it shouldn't make us angry at other people. It should force us, I think, to just do a little introspection into our own selves and what kind of life we're living, and the liberties that we are afforded here to have the religious liberty to celebrate and to live as we please and to feel proud of our identity. Take a look at the last page. I left you the blessings for Hanukkah. Hanukkah starts actually on Tuesday night. And how do we light the menorah? Really briefly, we light the first night. How many candles the first night? One. And we go up. We follow the principle of Hillel and the Talmud, Malim B'Kodesh. We always increase in holiness. So every night we light another candle. There are three blessings the first night, and then two blessings for each subsequent night, because the first night gets the blessing of, take a look at the sheet, the Shechiyanu. If you want to say them, we'll study, we'll do them together. Baruch atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam, Asher Kedushanu B'Mitzvotav B'Tzivanu, has commanded and sanctified us, Lahadlik Ner Shel Chanukah, to light the candle of Chanukah. The second one is the blessing over the miracle, Sha'asa Nisim La'avoteinu, God who performs miracles for our forefathers, Bayamim Ahem, back then, Bazman Hazeh, and to this day. And finally, on the first night, we make the blessing of renewal of Shechiyanu. What happens on Friday night? What's that? Well, when would you light? You light the Hanukkah menorah, but when? You have to light before Shabbat starts. And you then light the Shabbat candles afterwards, because you bring in Shabbat with Shabbat candles, and you have to light the menorah before, because if you light the Shabbat candles, you're accepting Shabbat. And therefore, you can't light afterwards. The only thing that's different, how long do the candles need to last? So we say about 30 minutes. I'm not going to get into all the details why that is. Candles, now if the candles blow out, you don't have to redo them as long as they were lit for a bit. But on Friday, what time is Shabbat? The candles are supposed to light, are supposed to be lit 30 minutes into the evening. So by the way, you can light the menorah all night. You come home late from work or a party or something like that. You should try to light the candles as early as you can in the evening, because we try to always do mitzvot as soon as we can to show our zealousness and our interest, not being lax and letting it go later. But for whatever reason, you come home late, you can light the menorah any time. You're supposed to light the menorah and put it where? In the window or someplace where other people will see it, because the mitzvah is what's called Pirsumei Nisa. It's supposed to publicize. This is not an internal. Shabbat candles, I'm going to speak about this Saturday night, are really to illuminate your home within. The menorah, the lights of the Hanukkah candles, is really to publicize the miracle to those on the outside. If you have a windowsill with a beautiful view of the brick wall of the adjacent building, like many of us have, you don't have to put it in the windowsill. You can just put it in a place in your apartment which gets the most traffic. The other thing you can do is to put it across, open up your door, and it's going to sound a little weird, and put it opposite the mezuzah, so that the people in the hallway will see it. But you don't have to do that. I'm saying if you don't really have any... the reason why it's actually better in New York City, you're supposed to light when people are walking around and can see it. New York City pretty much covers any time. Meshuggah is walking around at 3 in the morning, so you could probably still light it very late at night if need be. But you want to let it go 30 minutes into the evening, which is why Friday, your Hanukkah candle should be thicker. Or put a little more oil if you're using oil. Why? Because Shabbat starts early. You're lighting at like 4:10 or something, 4:15, so you need to then do the menorah earlier than that. So, and you want the candle to be lit 30 minutes into the night. So it needs to stay lit for like a good hour, hour and a half. Because we start Shabbat before sunset, not sundown. So it just needs to be thicker. Yeah, question, two questions.
Somebody else asked this question.
So you feel justified.
But it's a great question. Why does it say the blessing King of the universe who sanctified us and commanded us to light?
Excellent.
The Hanukkah,
so even though God did not command us per se, because this is a rabbinic holiday, God did command the Jewish people to heed to the words of the sages based on a verse in the Torah in the book of Numbers. We're supposed to listen. That's why we have all of these rabbinic laws, right? Some are positive, some are negative. You know, the safeguards, right? The fences, right? And then you have some positive mitzvot like this. You say the same thing when a woman, one second, lights candles on a Friday night. She also says the language, Asher kedushanam stav tzvenu lahadlik ner shel Shabbat. Lighting candles for Shabbat is not biblical either. There are a lot of things that we do that are rabbinic that we put that language, God who commanded, because He commanded us to heed the words of the sages, and the sages were the ones who ordained this. It's a good question. You have a question in the back?
Yeah. Does everyone need to light their own menorah?
No. You can have one menorah lit in... The custom is yes, unless you're in the same family, and then you could subsume. Or if you want to teach your kids. The custom is everyone has their own menorah, but if you don't have one, you can be mitztaref, which means... you can be included in someone else's lighting. But you're supposed to light in your home. Because your home should have the menorah. So even if you get invited to a Hanukkah party and they're all gathering around the menorah and doing one big lighting, you're supposed to technically still light when you get home yourself. Yeah?
What would make menorah not kosher? Like,
I guess if it was like looked like this. It needs to be clear how many nights of the holiday it is.
And does one candle need to be higher than other candles? Or can they be at the same level?
No, I think you should try to make it as simple and uniform as possible. The shamish is what you use to light the other candles, but that should be higher or lower so that it's not mistaken as one of the days of the holiday. But you could technically blow out the shamish after you light the other candles. The reason you don't light a candle to another candle and you use what's called the shamish, the leader, is because the point of the Hanukkah candles is presume nisa, the Talmud says, is to publicize the miracle. It's not to create light. You're not allowed to benefit from the light. In fact, there's a song. It's right over here. Take a look. You see the middle paragraph? We kindle these lights to commemorate the saving acts, miracles and wonders which you have performed. Through the 8 days of Hanukkah, these lights are sacred, and we are not permitted to make use of them, but only to look at them to order for thanks and praise. What does that mean, we can't make use of them? You're not supposed to use them to read. Or you're not supposed to use them to read or do anything practical with them. They're purely symbolic to represent the miracle of Hanukkah. So that's why we don't take a candle from one of the other candles and light it, because we're not supposed to have any benefit, physical benefit. It's supposed to publicize the miracle to the world. As opposed to Shabbat candles, which are specifically designed to illuminate your home. That's why when you light Shabbat candles, you should try to light them in an area where you'll actually gain benefit from the light. Even if it just creates a little romantic ambiance. But you want to be in vicinity of that and not just light them and be in another room. Yeah?
Who sort of is
sort of like Shabbat candles, the woman of the household is first line of defense.
First line defense. But if there's no woman in the house, the man lights it.
So how about for Hanukkah candles? Who is
doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Usually, for a family, the husband traditionally will light the menorah for the family, and I don't know why I keep thinking of that. Or they'll have the kids because of chinuch purposes, just to educate kids so they'll get their own menorah to be able to recite the blessings. But a woman can light her own menorah. It's not a, you know.
So there's not like a.
No. Did you have a?
Oh, no.
You were just scratching or whatever. Any other? You had your hand up before.
Well, yeah. I was going to ask.
That was like 2 hours ago.
Yeah, if you can get married on Hanukkah, because you're not supposed to fast.
You can always get married. You can actually, the Talmud says that you can even get engaged on Tisha B'Av. Not terribly romantic, but even if, seriously, Talmud explicitly states that you can get engaged on Tisha B'Av. Anybody know the reason the Talmud says you can get engaged on Tisha B'Av? Because someone else might snatch her up. Yeah, it's no joke. It's very practical. But we don't have weddings on, I think we don't get married on Hanukkah because we have a principle in the Talmud, Ein Ma'arvim Simcha B'Simcha. We don't mix one Simcha with another Simcha because it takes away. So you get married when you can focus the positive, happy energy on the couple, and you have Hanukkah when you can focus the happy, positive energy on the holiday. So we try not to mix the two. That's all. Is this an issue? That
no, because if we're saying you can't fast on Hanukkah, but you're supposed to fast on your wedding day.
Oh, very good. Right. There is a custom to fast on the wedding day. Correct. Correct. Men and women.
Except for Moshe Dovish as well. That's the way to get around this.
It's a custom. It's not a rule. Don't worry about it. If you're not a good faster, you don't have to fast on your wedding day. It is a custom, though. It's a beautiful custom. Any other Hanukkah questions? First of all, how do you pronounce it? We're going to get rid of this right now. I want to hear everybody chaying. No more Hanukkah. It's the next level. We cha here. Hanukkah. Okay, what do we say to each other? We say Hanukkah Sameach or Happy Hanukkah. Happy Hanukkah. Thank you. If you're Russian or you're doing a poor imitation of Russians, you can say Happy Hanukkah. Any other questions or comments or insights about... yes, Mariana.
So in college, we weren't allowed to light candles in our dorms. So we would light our menorahs anyway, but we wouldn't put them in the window, and then we would just go to each other's dorm rooms to look at our menorahs to publicize them.
Right.
Not like a kosher way of doing
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Well, you lit them? First, you,
yeah, we broke the rule.
You broke the rule.
We broke the rules, but we didn't want to put it in the window because we didn't want our race to see.
So therefore, so how did...
So we would just walk through, like we would...
Yeah, yeah, that's totally fine. Yeah, that's fine, because Persume Nisa today, that's kind of funny. By the way, the most incredible story of Hanukkah, candle menorah lighting, is in Natan Sharansky's book, Fear No Evil. It's in the book I'm writing. I put it in there. It's the most incredible story. How Sharansky observed Hanukkah in the Gulag, in a Soviet prison. It's just unbelievable. And that wasn't your experience in college. You know, you had some rules, but you can fulfill the mitzvah of Persume Nisa, publicizing it internally today. So even if you're just a group of people there, that's enough. Better if you can put it in the window, but if you can't, you can do that. That's fine as well. You know? Anybody have a menorah? We can get like one of the tin jobs for like $5. Not a big deal. We want to try. I don't know if you're accustomed to do this, to try every night of the holiday to light the menorah. It's a very, very beautiful mitzvah. We're going to be having a Hanukkah...
Really, when, Rabbi?
Chagiga next Wednesday night. It's going to be unbelievable.
I think I'm going to be here.
Yes. Are we fine? We have to talk about it. Okay. It's going to be a lot of fun. Next week, one-on-one learning. We're going to continue to have one-on-one learning from 7 to 8. I'm going to cut it a little short to teach a little Hanukkah stuff, a little Hanukkah Torah at about 7:40. And then at 8 o'clock, we're going to have a menorah lighting ourselves. And then like a party and dancing and food and a lot of fun. What else do you eat on Hanukkah? Latkes and sufganiyot. Just oily things.
Aren't you supposed to eat dairy?
There is a custom for some people who eat dairy because of Yehudit who chopped off the head of the Greek general. I didn't have time to talk about that.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, there's a dairy thing for the decapitation of a Greek general. Okay, I don't want to. Yeah. Happy Hanukkah, everyone. It's going to be great. What do you do, by the way, even though we're lighting the menorah here, what do you do when you get home?
Light
your menorah. Okay. All right, have a great night, everyone.